We are Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, listener-supported community radio. And it is time for the third Monday Farm and Garden Show. I am Dan Imhoff, and Tim Bates is scheduled to be in with us. We have a very special guest to talk to us today about grass-fed grazing, chicken raising, intensive chicken raising, and numerous other very innovative things that he's doing on his farm in southwestern Virginia. Today, we're going to be talking with Joel Salatin. He's an author, a farmer extraordinaire, who has an extremely innovative grass-fed rotational pasture farm in southwestern Virginia, which I had the pleasure of visiting last summer. And on just 100, the farm itself is about 500 acres, and on just 100 of those acres, the Salatin family manages to raise some 40,000 dozen eggs and 12,000 broiler chickens on a rotational system that we're going to talk about. We're going to bring Joe on the air. Hello, Joe. Can you hear us?
Yes, I can hear you fine.
Okay, Joel. Maybe you can describe to our listeners where we are, where you are, and what kind of day you're having out there.
Well, we're right in the middle of Virginia's Shenandoah Valley, near Stanton, which is known as the Queen City of the Valley. It's midway between Winchester and Roanoke, and the valley is 100 miles long and about 20 miles wide in the western part of Virginia. We're at 1,800 feet elevation at our house. Today it's about 65 degrees. We've had 3 days of fog and rainy, cold 40s and low high 30s. Today we've got some sun and about 65. It feels good.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place, and it's kind of a high elevation area, a place where you told me on our walk through your property we spent about a day walking all over up and down the hills and the pastures to the little pig farms and pastures and chicken houses. It was a place, though, in the Civil War where they tried to grow a lot of corn and grains.
Yes, this was known as the breadbasket of the Confederacy during the Civil War, and it was partly because of the elevation that allowed a high-gluten wheat to be grown that, of course, after the Civil War, as the opening of the Transcontinental Railroad in Illinois and the West, and the Midwest, those areas, of course, displaced this area as a production for for mainline grain type agriculture, the Dakotas, where it was colder, a little harsher. But we're in the same hardiness zone here, horticulturally, as South Dakota.
And, so, in fact, there were bison there, apparently.
Absolutely, yes. This area, the valley here, was the main thoroughfare for the migratory herds that moved from Michigan down into Florida. And they didn't go as far east. Eastern Virginia was much more wooded, but this western part was not quite as wooded, and the Native Americans maintained pasture using fire to keep back the forestal encroachment and maintain these big open meadows for the migratory animals.
Now, the farm which you have is quite a beautiful, dramatic setting. It's mostly woods. It was a property that your parents bought. I don't know if your grandparents lived there before them.
No, it started with my parents. We came in 1961. I was only four, and so I'm second generation here now. And our personal family history here doesn't extend that far back. We've just been here for about 40 years.
And what was your father's interest in agriculture? And I know that the house itself was a beautiful stone house that I think dated back to the colonial days. How did he get interested in agriculture and just living in such a rural setting?
Well, my grandfather, Dad's father, was an early subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine, a charter subscriber when it first came out in about 1949 or 50.
Mm-hmm.
And always had a desire to farm and tried, but couldn't quite make a go of it there during the Depression. And always had a large garden, which he sold vegetables and had a large compost pile. Had a chicken house, kind of a pentagon, five-sided chicken house there. It sat on the corner of the garden that he would grow. He'd grow sugar beets, and in the winter he would skewer these sugar beets on finishing nails about 18 inches off the floor, let the chickens have fresh vegetables during the wintertime. Quite an innovative fella, and Dad got his penchant for agriculture from him and his desire for conservation practices and non-chemical approaches. And after a trial of farming in Venezuela, South America, we, after 14 years there, we basically had to flee during the coup, the uprising there in 1959, and returned to the States. So we looked at farms from basically in a day's drive from Washington, D.C., because he was still meeting with the Venezuelan ambassador, trying to get a settlement for the farm down there, that sort of stuff. And so we looked at farms from kind of North Carolina up into Pennsylvania and settled here.
Uh-huh.
And so that's how we arrived here into the most worn out, abused piece of ground in the county, for sure. And we've been building it up ever since.
And when you describe the abuse, what kind of abuse were you did you inherit when you got that piece of farm?
Well, for one thing, we had very, very deep gullies. Essentially, during the grain production era, your horses don't fall over on a hillside, so you can plow a steeper hillside than you can with a tractor. And so these hillsides here were all plowed and eroded. And of course, you know, the type of vegetation that was here before the plow came was prairie and forest, and in other words it was a permanent ground cover. And when the Europeans arrived here from Scotland and England and Germany, Ireland, they brought with them a very temperate type of agriculture, a grain-based, grain-based arable type of agriculture, rather than looking at the different climate here, which is, you know, thunderstorms, and we have plenty of days when it's 0 degrees in the wintertime, so you have a lot of winter frost heaving. A much harsher climate than the 40s, than the 40s, 50s, and 60s, and gentle, misty type rains in those parts of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in typical attitude, they came to the area and didn't wait to ask, well, what can we do here that works with the ground, works with the soil, works with the climate, to create a sustainable, regenerative, actually an enhanced, if you will, production system. Rather, they just pushed, in I would suggest an arrogant sort of way, a provincially arrogant sort of way, pushed that type of agriculture onto a bioregion for which it was not suited.
And your father had some pretty clear ideas. I gather that he was a real reader as well.
Absolutely.
So he'd read about grass. He'd read a French text on grass farming that really influenced how you began to look at your land as a family.
Yes, very much so. He got a hold of some of this early, what's called now, controlled grazing material. Andre Voisin wrote a book on it. He's probably the godfather of the system, although you can go clear back to Chaucer and find texts that talk about going through France and those parts of Europe, and he was describing the Crusaders' letters home, and talking about ambulatory chicken houses and that sort of thing dotting the countryside. So, you know, we're not talking about new things here. We're talking about being able to take the innate physiological distinctive habitat of the domestic stock and raise them in a way that allows their natural distinctiveness to be fully expressed rather than squelched like the current, you know, modern factory farming system does.
And
so, yes, he read those texts and realized that there were, you know, the principles of a perennial forage cover, rotated animals, and basically a system that mimics the grazing herds, the buffalo and the wildebeest on the Serengeti, that mimics those grazing herds, is the system that creates the healthiest animals, the most nutritious meat, and enhances the ecology of the region, grows the better grass, and makes the earthworms do better.
So his basic big insight was, let's get out of this annual tillage of annual crops that require huge amounts of fertilizers and other treatments, and get into a perennial grass system, which could then produce a crop. And when you look at the pastures laid out on your farm, though, that those open pasture lands that you have, of which there are about 100 acres, are completely surrounded and intersected by steep woods and ravines and hills beyond.
Yes. What developed then was essentially landscaping on a large scale, and the three great environments are open land, forest land, and water, or, you know, we call them riparian areas. And so we began early on basically laid down a geographical or topographical template, and said, okay, this area is a riparian area, this area is a open land, and this area is a forestal zone. And so we created this patchwork using the hillsides, the swales, the ridgetops as a topographical template, so that the landscape describes its own use, as opposed to us mandating onto that landscape what we think it needs to have.
Mm-hmm.
And so the landscape then speaks to us and defines its own use based on its aspect, slope, you know, water, that sort of thing.
I'd just like to remind our listeners that we are speaking with Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm in the Shenandoah Valley of southwestern Virginia. Tim Bates, my co-host, has joined the conversation here.
I have arrived.
And I'm sure once we get into some of the specifics about your particular system, Joel, Tim will have a lot of questions, because he and his daughter have been experimenting with your broiler shelter techniques on their apple farm here in the valley.
Ah, good.
That was my daughter's project. She would have more questions, but I couldn't get her to come down here.
So let's get into the exciting part about this farm, because it is an extraordinary place. And we have the groundwork now. Your family has had it for a couple generations now, and it was a very, improperly, inappropriately, agriculturally abused landscape that you decided to restore, but not take out of production, but restore in a way where you would bring in perennial systems and not go on certain areas which would just cause further degradation of the landscape, and instead try to develop a very diverse system of land use that works with the surrounding wilds. And what you've come up with, I don't know what started first, but whether you got cattle and cows on the ground first.
Yeah, the first thing that we had was cattle. I mean, we did have fields, we did have grass on some areas. And so the first thing that we had was cattle, and then it gradually, you know, moved into some of these other things, and more recently has moved even faster. But cattle were the foundation, and of course those were in the days when we didn't know then what we know now, and we started with that, which of course, unfortunately, is the slowest healer. The larger the animal, the slower the healing. The smaller the animal, the faster the healing. Of course, the, you know, the flip side of that is the larger the animal, the less labor per acre that it takes. The smaller the animal, the greater the labor per acre. So there's no free lunch, but from a land healing standpoint, definitely the smaller the animal, the faster the healing. So, you know, we started probably with the, you know, maybe with the wrong thing, but anyway, hindsight's 20/20.
Right, and now you've developed a system where you are incorporating multiple animals in the grazing system. So on your typical grass-fed beef farm, you would basically have, whether it's meat or dairy, you'd have a person who is dividing the land up into paddocks and keeping an intense number of cattle there for a certain period of time, and then quickly moving them on to another one that's going to give the ground a chance to regenerate, and then that system can just be rotated throughout the season. And now what you've done is you're using that technique, but you're also using other animals besides cattle in the process.
Yes. If you think about it, the way it was back, you know, 400 years ago, you had basically the buffalo, which were the, you know, the queen herbivore, if you will, and then you had the antelope or elk, deer, that sort of thing that came along behind or with and through, and then you had a lot of the poultry. You had prairie chickens, pheasant. You had all sorts of fowl, turkeys, grouse, and so what we're trying to do is mimic that basic undulation, that multi-species undulation on the land. And each one of those species has a different palatability index of vegetation. You know, what's one animal's weed is another's ice cream. And so you get this, you're trying to mimic on a domestic scale the natural undulating, stacking, multi-speciation of what was here naturally. And what's wonderful is that with things like electric fencing now and wood chippers and composting and front-end loaders and some of the things that the Western, you know, reductionist, compartmentalized, systematized mind has brought to us, when we marry that information-dense inventions, technology, if you will, you know, 15-year stabilized cloth covers for hoop structures, things like that, we can marry that with the heritage wisdom of the animals. We have a symbiosis that's hard to describe. It's a real exciting thing.
It is. Now, let's get into it. So you start your year, and let's say you're just dealing with one large 30 to 40-acre pasture. What rotates through that pasture throughout the season?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's start with the cows. That's probably an easy place to start. So first green up in the spring, the cows go in that pasture, which is divided into several paddocks, and those paddock sizes vary. Every grazing, the paddock sizes will vary. So with the portable electric fence, we're able to define what is, as André Voisin called it, he's the French godfather of controlled grazing, he called it rational grazing, in that we ration out the forage so that the picture is of a plate. And so that you give the cows a plate of forage that is one day's meal, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And So after the cows move on, then the eggmobile comes behind them, and this is an eggmobile. These are two that are hooked together with about 700 or 800 laying chickens, and the chickens then free range out from the eggmobile and scratch through the cow patties that the cows drop, which attract pathogens and flies. And the chickens then scratch through those, eat out the fly larva, spread out the cow patties to stimulate nutrient cycling so that the cow patties don't just lie in a little, 8-inch by 8-inch spot. They're actually spread out to a 3-foot by 3-foot area, which eliminates the repugnancy zone, balances out the nutrients going onto the soil. And, of course, they convert the grasshoppers and crickets and things like that into eggs, and basically mimic the egret that's on the rhino's nose. Birds follow herbivores naturally throughout the world, and so there goes the eggmobile.
And the eggmobile itself, I have a picture. Joel, I have a very nice essay on the Salatin Polyface Farm in Farming with the Wild, a new book that I've just recently published, and the eggmobile is nothing fancy. It's it's a pretty simple structure that's mostly utility. And how many hens follow how many cows?
You don't need but about probably one or two hens per cow to actually do the work.
Mm-hmm.
But with so many of these systems, once you get the prototype down and it works, then, that's the eastern part, the eastern holistic part is how do we integrate this? How do we connect it? How do we prototype it and make it work in symbiosis? Then once you do that, then you're always wrestling with efficiency, which is a more Western concept.
How do we
make this thing more efficient? So all you really need is probably one or two hens per cow, but we're running about 10 to 20 because the cost of the eggmobile is going out there, hooking it up with a tractor or a pickup truck or a team of horses or oxen and moving that eggmobile to its new spot. The cost, as I say, is in being there. So and then going out in the afternoon and gathering the eggs. Well, if you're going to go out and move it and go out and gather the eggs, it obviously makes the trip much more efficient if you bring in 40 dozen eggs rather than 5 dozen eggs for the same trip.
And at that point, then, are you also supplementing their grain?
Yes. Then at that point, we supplement the cream that they're getting off the pasture. We're supplementing that with GMO-free grain because the birds will not range any farther than about 200 yards from the eggmobile, whether there are 10 in it or 700 in it. And obviously, if you only have 100 in it, they can almost live off the land. 700 are going to touch the same land. They can't live off that same acreage because there's not enough, bugs and worms and fly larvae and things to eat on. But that's that's one of the tightropes of constantly trying to wed this Eastern and Western, the connectedness, and yet have enough commercial volume, enough production to pay the taxes and the keep shoes on your feet, that sort of thing.
Now, but that your rotational system doesn't stop there.
Oh no.
Yeah.
No. Then we come on, and we're doing this all in one paddock, but it touches all over the farm. We come on with the broiler chickens. The broilers are meat birds. Layers are egg layers. They're mature hens that lay eggs. Broilers, of course, are meat birds.
Now, your egg birds, as I remember, were Australorps and Rhode Island Reds?
Yes, and Barred Rocks.
And Barred Rocks, okay.
These are non-hybrids that would have been found on any early American pioneer homestead 150 years ago. We use the non-hybrids because they don't lay quite as well, and they're a lot more hardy.
Yeah, they're big birds, and they have a pretty good reputation for fending off raptors and predators, no?
Yes. So then we have the broilers, which move in field shelters. We have about 60 of these field shelters that are 10 feet wide, 12 feet long, and 2 feet high. They're just short, squatty, rectangular boxes. And we can put about 80 birds in there. They go in at about 14 to 15 days old, and then they spend about 6 more weeks growing out. And, of course, we supplemental feed them. But these field shelters, of course, protect them from predators because those are little chicks when they go in there. And that's quite a tasty morsel for a fox or a coyote or a raccoon or skunk. And so the field shelters protect them from predation and from weather. And we move them every morning to a fresh spot. So these shelters just run across the field like a group of migratory geese. And they get a fresh salad bar every single day.
Mm-hmm. So I watched you move them. It's really kind of a very simple system that you've rigged up. I can't remember if there are wheels on the back or you really just slip a dolly like structure underneath it and pull it 14 feet the length of the of the structure and then put it down and then go over and do the next one and make
That's
sure
right.
they have food and water and
That's right.
It's really pretty simple.
Yeah, it is. It's extremely simple. We don't use a machine or a tractor or anything to move them because it scares the birds. It's too difficult, too unwieldy. So these are all small enough to be moved by hand. We just have a portable dolly, which is like a little, portable axle. You slip under the back end, pick it up off the ground about 2 inches, high enough to clear the sod, but not high enough for the birds to come out. And you go around to the other end, and it just rolls on the wheels and goes to the next spot. And the chickens just, of course, walk. They walk on the ground to the next spot. And it works very simply. We can move a shelter in 1 minute, so one person can move those 60 shelters, which would be housing 4,800 birds, in about 60 minutes. So it really is not an arduous thing as you might think if you haven't ever done it.
No, I was just totally amazed how really machine-free your operations seem to be. And, just kind of manual observation intensive, but also that these structures themselves were just totally inexpensive, but well thought out, exactly what, you needed. And another thing that really struck me was actually how many of those broilers were in a little 10 by 12 by 2 foot structure.
Sure. Like I said, we put 80 in, and of course when they first go in, all 80 of those chicks would occupy a space that's, about 2 feet square maybe, and as they grow, of course, they get bigger. And the last week, then the shelter is probably two-thirds full and might look a little bit crowded to you. But remember, they're in small groups, and they get a fresh salad bar every day, so there's a lot to occupy their attention, and they're in small groups. Stress, my formula for stress is kind of mass times density. So, small groups can be perhaps as dense as a commercial operation, but because it's a small group, doesn't have the stress level. And it's kind of the difference between you can even be at your house, the family can sit down and watch a program on TV or listen to the radio for a program and be fairly tight, wedged in a
closet
tight floor spot. But if you did that same level of density times 10,000 in a stadium or some venue like that, that's where you have riots and goalposts broken down and that sort of stuff. So that's what I'm describing here with the poultry. It's one thing to have these birds in little 75 member units in a portable hutch, moved every day to a fresh spot. It's another thing to have 15,000 in a single, you know, football field sized house.
Yeah. And they're eating a lot of grass.
Oh, yes. They ingest a tremendous amount of grass. And, of course, that grass is the foundation for the carotenes, the B vitamins, the polyunsaturated fats, and the entire nutritional profile that completely changes the structure of the eggs, meat, milk, beef, anything that's produced on grass. And what we have done in American agriculture is we have essentially eliminated the grass or the salad bar component from the diet of all animals, from poultry to dairy to beef to pigs to everything. We've eliminated that salad bar green material component from all the animals, and that is the foundation of health.
Well, and it was very interesting a comment that you made to me as a livestock grower. You were saying that at the typical livestock conference, most of the time, most of the workshops, most of the information will be concentrated on disease.
Sure.
And how you control diseases in confinement. And this system seems to me to try to be taking it from a fundamentally different point of view, which you just described.
Sure, absolutely. The question that we want to ask is, how can we make the chicken fully express her chickenness? Or how can we make the pig fully express his pigness? Because if we can find the answer to that question, then all of a sudden, the animal is happy, healthy, we don't have vet bills, we don't have sickness, and amazingly, the nutritional profile of what the animal produces, the nutritional profile, completely changes. And, from conjugated linoleic acid to the riboflavins to all these wonderful things. And so our question is not how fast can we produce it, how cheap can we produce it, or any of those kinds of me-centered, egocentric type questions, but rather, how can I make this critter as happy as it can be, and then amazingly everything else kind of falls into place.
Mm-hmm. Now, your rotational system doesn't stop. It goes cows, hens, laying hens, broilers, and then sometimes you add other animals into that rotation, right?
Well, we also have sheep,
mm-hmm.
and the sheep are in a 1,500 square foot hoop structure. It's portable. Again, this is the wonderful thing about some of our technology today, in that we can actually have a 1,500, this thing's big, it's 30 feet by 50 feet, we can have a 1,500 square foot portable barn. 50 years ago, if you had a 1,500 square foot barn, the thing would be built out of oak 8x8s and weigh 40 tons, and you couldn't move it with all the horses in the town. And today, using extruded steel arches, hoop structures, and 15-year UV-stabilized web 20-mil poly covering, we can actually have an entire 1,500-square-foot facility that can be moved, that only weighs about a ton and a half, and can be put in the back of a pickup truck. So it's the ultimate information-based, where everything is outsourced, downsized, restructured, miniaturized. It's that kind of thing.
Not only that, you can give great names to these structures, which you've done.
Sure. We call this, it's the portable sheepfold. We call it the Yugo, E-W-E-G-O. And so what we do is, this is like a portable sheepfold, and it moves through the field, and it has, and we use, there's a new kind of fencing out. It's only been out for about 20 years. It's a polyethylene webbed material with stainless steel wire threads running through the polyethylene. And this fence, it comes in roughly 150-foot rolls, and it's 4 feet high, and 150 feet of it only weighs about 8 pounds. So again, we're talking about an ultimate information-based type system, but it'll keep coyotes and predators out, keep the sheep in, highly portable, and we set up then quarter-acre paddocks like lobes of a clover out from the Yugo, and so we'll graze one lobe one day, then we move the fence, graze another lobe another day, move the fence. Once we've gone all the way around, like rosettes on, like petals on a flower, once we go all the way around the Yugo, we just pull it up the field to the next rosette and repeat the procedure. So the whole thing is completely portable, and the sheep can be on new ground, and we can, you know, stay in sync with the grass growth cycle that way.
And in order to keep the fertility and the nutrition in your grass, are you reseeding? And also, is the nutrients that all the animals are returning back to the soil, is that enough to supercharge it to keep this whole system going, or do you have to supplement it with compost and or other kind of fertilizers? I know also that when you were looking at restoring the degraded areas of the farm, one of the things you decided to do was to put in a few ponds, and those ponds help to irrigate, just get you through some of those dry summer spells, even though you do get summer rainfall.
Yes, those are all good questions. A lot of questions there, Dan, kind of strung together. Let me start with the reseeding. We essentially don't reseed. What we want is to grow whatever grows in the side ditches. We're not enamored of all these new species. We want just whatever's natural here to grow, and we want to create an environment that will allow the seed bank to go ahead and germinate, because many of these seeds, from clovers to grasses to medics, will actually remain dormant in the soil for literally hundreds of years until the climate is right for them to germinate. And so what we're trying to do is create a germination-friendly climate for them. So that's a fairly easy question to answer, the first part, the reseeding. Now, about the supplementation, as we described the farm in such a state of erosion, I mean, there was so little soil on a lot of these hills that Dad actually poured concrete in car tires to make stanchions to hold up electric fence, little 3/8 inch rod electric fence stakes. There wasn't enough soil to hold up these little stakes. Today we don't use those. We can put in an electric fence stake anywhere on the place. So we've built that soil up, mm-hmm. and that's taken a lot of time and a lot of supplementation of just carbonaceous material. Our belief is that what runs the fertility program is the decomposition cycle. So everything we can do to stimulate the decomposition cycle is a positive thing. The main part of the decomposition cycle that we do from an input standpoint is in the winter when the forage is done and the cows are on hay, which is stored solar-dried forage. They spend the winter in a hay shed. It's open to the outside, but it's basically a large awning structure, just a shed, that we then bed down with straw, old hay, wood chips, sawdust that we get from a sawmill, chips that we get from these, you know, utility line chipping crews. We pay them $10 a load to dump here at the farm. And we bed that hay shed down, and it just builds up through the winter. So the cows are dropping their manure and urine onto the bedding pack, and the carbon is absorbing it, linking it down so that it doesn't vaporize if it gets dry, and it doesn't leach into the groundwater if it gets wet. There's no wetness there, no leaching, because the awning protects it from the winter rains. And mm-hmm. then we put corn in that bedding, and it ferments because it's anaerobic. The cows are tromping out the oxygen. It ferments. Then when the cows come back out to graze in the spring, then we go in with pigs. And those pigs then seek the fermented grain that's all through that bedding. That pays their salary to aerate it, to inject oxygen, and therefore we allow the pig to use the plow on the end of its nose, which is something that it loves to do, and fully express its pigness. And those pigs then turn that huge bedding pack to add oxygen so that it aerobically composts.
And you've even got a name for them.
Yeah, we call them piggerators.
Piggerators. So basically,
you know, aerobic dance, yes.
What you've got is a maybe 5 feet, 6 feet, 8 feet deep pile of the bedding.
Well, three to 4 feet would be more accurate.
Okay.
5-6 would be a little bit deep, but
okay.
Three to 4 feet would be accurate.
There's a lot of corn in there. There's a lot of bugs and things that they want. They're rooting around and just churning that all up. And is that the end of the composting or?
Yes, that's the end of it. And when they finish, then it's not a compost that is as fine and pure as what you'd buy in a bag at the
farm supply.
I'm trying to think of some of the sponsors I heard you say at the beginning of the show.
Dirt cheap.
Yeah, but the beauty of this is that at least the nitrogen, the volatile nutrients that you typically smell on a farm, have been metabolized by the bacteria, the microorganic material that digested it, so that when you spread it on the fields, there's no odor,
right,
and there's no leaching into the groundwater. And so when you smell it, it smells like, you know, you like humus, like leaves in a forest. And that's what we're after. And so that happens very, very rapidly because the pigs churn it, right along. They start, of course, on the top, and then they go deeper and deeper and deeper. In fact, this year it was so deep that we had to actually skim off. We're doing this in two cycles. We go in, we go down about 2 feet, and then we skim off that 2 feet and then reintroduce the pigs to get down to the other 2 feet because it's, even big pigs will only go about 3 feet. They can't quite reach to four.
They might never make it out.
Right, right. They just basically go through it like big egg beaters, you know, and they're digging down. They find these kind of like coal miners. They find these strata of corn that we've put in there, and they just fling the overburden out and just continue to moving right through there, and it's quite an amazing thing to see.
And how did you ever get to that point to figure out, aha, if we just put the pigs in there, then that will work?
Well, we're constantly looking for ways for animals to use their innate assets. And I was at a conference one day and was watching a presentation by a staff member of the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, ALBC, in I think it's Pittsburgh, North Carolina.
Uh-huh.
And she was simply showing some of these heritage breeds that they're trying to save, and one of the pictures was of a pig on top of a steaming pile of horse manure outside of a horse barn. Now, of course, the point of the picture had nothing to do with the pig turning it or even rooting it. The pig wasn't even rooting it. It was just that's where the pig was standing when she took the picture, and it was some heritage breed. But I saw that picture. It was quite surreal. You know, it was like a stroke from above, you know, and I saw that picture and it just struck me, you know, what pigs would do in this bedding. Because what we were doing at the time, this was, you know, 15 years ago, we were doing what most other organic farmers do, and that was cleaning out this bedding and building windrow compost piles.
Right.
And, of course, that meant double handling it. And it's also very difficult to dig out because it's all pressed together and compacted from the livestock. And when I saw that, it was just, you know, like a stroke from above. And I came home then the very next year, and we did it on a trial basis in a section with just a couple of pigs, and it worked so beautifully that we immediately did the whole thing. Now we do hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of tons of this stuff, and we use up to 150 pigs to do it all. But as the fertility has come up and the grass has come up, where the farm when I was a kid used to only sustain about 10 or 12 cows, now we do over 100, and of course that just generates more compost, more material to feed more earthworms, to make the soil more healthy, to grow more grass. You know, it becomes a wonderful Edenic type atmosphere.
This is great.
The size of that hay barn, then, if you're making 100 tons or something out of that, how big is that?
Well, where the cows go. Well, it's big enough to house almost 200 head of animals.
Well, that's big.
So you know, it's pushing, I don't know, half an acre maybe under roof space, and you get 4 feet deep, 4 feet of compost on something between a quarter to a half an acre.
I can do the math.
Yeah, it's hundreds of tons. It's a huge pile.
Is that another high-tech kind of a barn? I mean, new tech? That's an old-style, big old barn.
Yeah, it's just a pole shed. It's just a pole shed. In fact, the rafters are just long oak poles from the woods that we didn't even... Most of the rafters are not even milled, you know, milled board rafters. It looks like something you'd see in the third world, but...
It's not that.
We have a few hand-hewn beams around here still, too.
Oh, yeah, we do.
We've seen that.
We do.
It's quite it's a red barn. It's a real classic kind of functional barn, as I remember it.
Yeah, but it is a pole structure. It's not a bank barn or anything. It's just a pole structure, essentially with a roof and awnings.
Uh-huh.
And all it does is provide protection for this bedding from the rain and the sun. That's the idea. Of course, the wonderful benefits to the animals from a winter feeding like this is that bedding pack, which is fermenting, stays warm. Mm-hmm. So those cows, rather than lounging on cold concrete or frozen or muddy ground, are on this wonderful, soft, warm bedding pack of dry, carbonaceous wood chips, sawdust, old hay. So it's magnetic for the cows. And very comfortable for them because it's clean and dry and warm, even when it's, 0 degrees.
And some styles in Northern Europe where and then you built your house up above that because that kept you warm, too.
Yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm.
I really have to ask you a question about killing chickens and slaughter. One of the most amazing things to me was walking throughout the entire farm for a day with you, and I, not really picking up on and seeing so many animals on this place, but not really getting a feeling like an overpowering manure, you know, ammonia smell that you might in other confinement operations. So these animals are spread out. But not only are they spread out, they're healthfully spread out because you're not having this huge concentration of waste. And this was a hot summer. It wasn't a hot summer day, but it was during the summer there in the southeast. I do remember going by one stainless sink that did smell of slaughtered chickens. And for anybody who were to take on this, you know, a project like you've described, what's it like to kill chickens, and how fast can you do it, and what are some of the things that you've learned along the way? Because I assume you're doing most of the slaughtering there.
Yes, we do. We do the poultry here. With our little shed facility here, we have a rotisserie scalder, and we have a we kill in cones. So you put them in these cones, so the head comes out the bottom, and then we don't do electrocution like the industry does. We just slit their jugular. That way, the autonomic nervous system continues to function and actually pumps the blood out of them rather than draining the blood, and you get a much better bleed, and the bird just gradually gets lightheaded and closes its eyes and fades away. Not a painful or difficult thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then we scald the birds in a rotisserie scalder. It's like a barrel mounted on its side with a perforated grate inside, like a paddle wheel, that moves around, and the birds then scald in there, and then we have a little automatic feather picker that can pick about 5 birds in 20 seconds automatically. It's a spinning with rubber fingers in it. And then we eviscerate by hand. And we can run 200 birds an hour through our setup with about 8 people. It takes about one person per 25 birds, which, interestingly, is about the same ratio that the big, you know, factory operations require. So we feel pretty happy about our efficiency on that. And even though a lot of it's done by hand, we don't have as many maintenance employees, as many whirring engines to break down. So there's, you know, there's definitely an efficiency in being small as opposed to being large.
And I think you said that you usually do it just one day per week.
Roughly one day a week. For sake of discussion here, no reason to get into all the little nuances, but yeah, roughly one day a week we'll process birds.
Mm-hmm.
And then we take all the offal, the feathers, the blood, and the guts, the intestines, and we compost them just 20 feet away in a, using wood chips as a compost system. And all of the processing water goes into a concrete lagoon adjacent to the structure that we periodically pump out onto the pasture as a nutrient-dense fertilizer.
And what is amazing about all this production is that it's really sold within a couple-hour drive of your farm at the most.
Yes, yes. We have 4 marketing venues, 4 legs to our marketing stool. 35% of our sales go to on-the-farm customers who come right here to the farm. That's our bread and butter. These are folks, we send out a newsletter in the spring to these folks, and they order for the season and actually come right out to the farm and pick things up. 35% of our sales are to upscale restaurants in the Charlottesville, Washington, D.C. area. Washington, D.C. is 150 miles away, so that's roughly 3 hours.
Right.
And so that accounts for about 35% of our sales. And then 10% of our sales are metropolitan buying clubs. We have 5 of those, and that's where a group of families will get together, and we service them bi-monthly every 8 weeks. And they'll order, and we make a drop-off, you know, about once every other month for them. And then 20% of our sales are metropolitan farmers markets that we are in, and we use an agent to go there. We don't go personally. A fellow stops by every Friday, picks up stuff in a refrigerated truck, and takes it to the farmers markets. So we have a multifaceted marketing venue as well as, you know, the different things that we offer.
Sounds like you get to stay on the farm quite a bit.
Well, that's the idea.
I like that one.
Yeah, that's the idea. And the guy that takes our bird, that does the restaurant route, he also is a subcontractor and is you know, the whole route salesman thing, so that we get to stay on the farm and not have to beat the pavement.
Excellent. You're getting the price you need. Sounds like you might be.
Well, yeah, pricing is always a tightrope. You know, you don't want to charge too much, but you got to cover your expenses, and so we try to price things just what we need. We don't have desires to, you know, become millionaires or anything, but we do want to be able to make enough that we can, that it's desirable for the next generation to come on. And Dan, since you were here, our son, Daniel, has gotten married and has built a house on the farm. He and his new wife, and so we're real excited about it moving into the next generation.
Yeah, I mean, that it's just fantastic to see such a, well, an operation that's running just on family power. I think there were a couple interns there the day that I was there, but your wife was there handling orders, and your son was doing a bunch of tasks, and you were dealing with people who were even coming in to buy lumber.
Yes.
you have a small scale sawmill
that's correct.
Then you can use, because actually the one thing that we haven't focused on is that so much of this property is really just woods, and woods that are connected to much wilder lands to the west, I think.
Yes, we abut we abut a game commission property, which then abuts the George Washington National Forest here. So we abut those areas on the west. And our sawmill is allowing us to add, we have 450 acres of woodland that needs to be shepherded and stewarded. And so we've been able to convert some of that into lumber, which we use for our own building projects, like our son's house. we cut the logs, milled the lumber, and he built the house, and as well as to sell. And neighbors, of course, bring over some of their own logs that they get in their projects, and we can help them, you know, mill those into lumber for them. So it's a neat community service to be able to offer milled lumber in the community.
Mm-hmm. And you've chosen not to be certified organic.
That is correct. We call ourselves Beyond Organic.
All right.
as the government has taken over our language and now owns the terminology, you know, it's important to remember that one of the first things they did in slavery was to forbid the slaves to speak in their native tongue. And those of us who have been the pioneers of the movement have now been our words, our terminology has now been co-opted, and we've been forbidden to use the terminology that we created by the government as the empire building of organics runs its course. I call it the Wall Streetification of organics. And the truth is that an empire by any other name is still an empire. And and so this lack of integrity in the system now, where, you know, range poultry is not, you know, blue skies, green grass. It's, you know, it's 10,000 birds in a house with a 30-foot by 30-foot dirt exercise yard adjacent to it. People are beginning to realize this, you know, the gamesmanship and the wordsmanship, the doublespeak that's been played as the government has co-opted our vocabulary and forbidden those of us who don't toe the system and pay for the system, forbidden us to use the terminology. And so that's why we call our beef salad bar beef and pastured poultry and pigerator pork and those kinds of things. We haven't talked about turkeys and rabbits and stuff, but maybe another day. The point is that we have tried to create inventive terms that so we don't fall into the temptation of having hardening of the categories.
Well, that was really well put. I couldn't have possibly said it any better than that about what's happening with organics. And they certainly wouldn't allow you to have that innovative way of making your compost.
That's for sure. You'd have to be measuring, has to go up to a certain temperature, which is too high for the microbiology.
Yeah, you get that fried compost when you buy it now. It's like black and dead almost.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like we're going to have to perhaps beg you to come back another day. Joel Salatin, it's been a great hour. Maybe you can tell the listeners the names of a couple of your books and how to find them. And I certainly encourage them to, and maybe just mention the title of the book that you're working on right now.
All right. The books are all available through Chelsea Green Publishing. They're available at your bookstore. Go ask for it. You can ask for me by name or by book title. Or you can call Acres USA at 1-800-355-5313 and get it over the Acres bookshelf section.
And that would be salad bar beef.
Salad bar beef.
Pastured poultry profits.
Profits, that's correct. And then You Can Farm.
Mm-hmm.
That's for all the newbies and wannabes. And the latest
book. How do you spell
you
on that one?
Was family-friendly farming. And the one I'm working on right now is untitled, but it's essentially this whole, it's going to be dealing with the whole East meets West in the organic, the dilemma that we have in organics of an Eastern production model trying to market through a Western marketing paradigm.
Great.
And the one is connected, the other is disconnected. How do we marry a connected production model to a disconnected lifestyle? And so I'm exploring all that, and it'll be an exciting book.
We'll try to get you on to talk about it. Thank you very much, Joel.
Thanks a lot, Joel.
Thanks for having me.
Take care.
Thank you.